are in Baird country.
We are here. Sean, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I should probably do an intro.
Okay. For anybody that is not aware, we have Sean James here today. He is owner of the YouTube channel My Self Reliance, as well as the YouTube channel Sean James. He also has his own podcast that he's running off his Sean James channel, and he is a legendary self-reliance expert, homesteader, log cabin builder, canoeist, fisherman, hunter, backcountry traveler, you name it. Sorry, you got to pump your tires, Sean, but it's true.
Oh, yeah.
it's really awesome to have you here today and talk to me on what's my very first podcast.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I'm honored to be the first.
No problem.
Pressure's off. I think Jim was I attempted to have you on as my first too.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if that, yeah, it might have been the first episode that I interviewed you four and then didn't use it because we crashed, but
yeah
we're trying again.
Well, yeah, that's good because I've had issues getting stuff dialed in. It's like not as easy as you might think it would all be, everything that goes into it.
Another learning curve we talked about earlier, about moving from one, like being nimble, and this is the next platform that people are listening to, including myself, right? So I think they said something like YouTube or video, let's say, gets a, I think it's something like 10 times. Podcast listens are about 10 times what views are on video platforms.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, it's so much easier to consume because you're driving or you're working on a piece of heavy equipment or you're pretending to do schoolwork or work.
Yeah, right. You're multitasking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, same thing with audiobooks. I'm like, I used to read a lot more, and then I got busy with work. Then now we have our internet on the phone, which keeps you busy with work, keeps you, you know, especially when your job is related to sharing stuff on socials and stuff like that. You're busy doing that. I don't have the kind of time to read. And now I'm just finding podcasts and audio books are just somewhere I can just save a ton of time. So
I think for me too, the one thing that's interesting about podcasts is that, well, for me especially, I've become sort of isolated, and my wife and I are sounding boards and echo chambers for each other. So you lose perspective on what's going on in everybody else's life. So it's good to start talking to people, but people are so busy, and not many people have the freedom that we have being entrepreneurs with you and I and your family and my family. You're kind of doing different things. You don't go to a 9-to-5 job. So how do you even coordinate trips and things with people that have to get time off when we're so flexible? That's already a challenge, but having these conversations on a podcast is sometimes a lot easier than getting together to have with your buddies or your family and having real conversations. So it's an opportunity to have real long form conversations instead of the, you know, little snippets we do on social media typically.
Yeah, totally. And it's also just like you're saying, you get, I don't know about me, but you definitely seem someone who's you love kind of all different sort of areas of like self-reliance and outdoors kind of stuff, right? And to talk to somebody else that we, you know, we can get, like, I'm more on the, you know, expeditionary canoeing side, but I love it all. So to talk to you about somebody that has more experience building cabins, hunting, all these kinds of things, like, you know, that takes years to build up the, like, the knowledge for any of these kinds of things. So sitting down and talking to somebody like you is a way that I can just, like, learn so much more about that kind of stuff too, you know?
Well, I'm not sure what I have to teach, but it's different for sure, a little bit.
Well, trust me, you can build the hell out of a cabin a lot better than me. I've seen that that's why I've seen the cabin, the one where you built your new cabin, and it was the video where you built it from like the ground up, the whole thing together, and you're using pulleys that were strung on a guy between two trees, like really far apart or whatever, and you're using that all by yourself and getting them all into position one after another. How long did that take you?
It's an interest. People always, when they ask, how long did it take you? I'm like, what do you mean? Did it take me? I'm still taking
it. It's still doing it. Yeah.
So I'd have to say, okay, what was the beginning? What was the,
I guess just thinking that video, right? Like, you know, I think a lot of people, they'd look at something like that and be like, I don't have the staying power or the time to ever do this. So what, maybe a better question is like, when it's really hard and it's freezing cold outside, how hard is it to drag yourself out? Like, I know you enjoy this kind of stuff. You love it, but it's got to still be hard sometimes to be like, I got to go beast around a bunch of logs out. It's minus freaking 20 degrees and, you know, whatever. And you got to drag yourself out there and do it sometimes. Does it feel like that?
Two things about it. I would say one is that it took so long or longer than it would if I was just dedicated to just that thing.
Yeah.
So I was able to do other things that needed to get done. And some of them were equally interesting. Like I revealed recently that you would have noticed over the last 4 years that I've actually been working on two homesteads at the same time. So I'm hauling logs around one day and then I'm hauling around 2x4s and 2x6s and other wood and building gardens at the same time on another property that's an hour apart. So I'm going back and forth, sleeping here and sleeping there and waking up doing this work. Then next day I'm waking up doing this work. So I've been pounding it and people thinking, wow, that you built that cabin all alone and the amount of time to do that. It's like, hold my beer. Like that was just half. And I'm not arrogant. I don't literally think that way, but yeah. I'm like, all the things I haven't been able to show you I was doing that were equally difficult and time consuming. Behind the scenes.
You mean behind the scenes, just other, just
I built a whole nother home.
Well,
that too, but I built a whole nother home for my family, like with my wife.
Right.
Because COVID hit in 2020, the kids had to come back or had to go somewhere. When we had made this move up to the cabin, that cabin that you'd visited, my wife and I were living in that when the pandemic hit. We had to go to this place that we just started building and sleep on the floor and joked, we were literally showering out of a bucket. My girls too, because they had to leave the city and go to some safe place. So we started building that homestead up for the four of us forever or their extended family. So my mindset changed.
Yeah.
So I'm like stressed out trying to get content done for the audience, but I'm trying to get two places built at the same time. And I don't know which one's going to be the one that really is what we need for self-sufficiency and self-reliance. So I have to build them up both at the same time to a point where they're like, they can carry themselves. And they're almost at that point now, but the amount of work that it's been taken.
Yeah.
But to answer specifically your question about the cabin, that video, I think I had spread over 2 years building it from the beginning to the dried in period, I would say, where the roof's on. Yeah. But it does get a little bit maybe boring when I'm putting the logs in place to build the walls up, because there's not much difference from one log to the other.
Well, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's just like the monotony of it. And like, you know, but I, at the same time, if I was the one building, if I'd built that cabin, I know that I would just sit there and stare at it for like a day straight, how cool what I've built was, you know, but I would just find the reason I've been, probably a lot of people can say this too, is like the challenge of starting a project like that is worrying. I'd be worried that I'm not going to finish it, or I'm going to get so burnt out and it's going to be too hard, even though I know that final product is going to be the dream. You know what I mean? And I just think, like, was it something for you that some days you're like, you know what? I really want to finish this cabin, but you're just thinking, I don't want to go up there and do that same thing again with the logs. Did you have days like that?
No, for sure I have. Yeah. I still get them, and it's okay. What do I need to work on? So there's two components. What do I want to work on, and what actually has to get done? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't back off on either one of them. And what we learned over the last 4 years, I don't know which one's going to be the more important place. And I don't want to leave somewhere deficient in that, because I have a family. So I'm thinking, okay, if the family needs to move into one, like daughters and their families, because they're 24 and 23 and we'll be starting families soon. Mm-hmm. So I want to shore this place up for them, and as well as this for my wife and I, or vice versa, if it happens to be vice versa. So each place has to have self-sufficiency in energy, water, food, and shelter.
Have you considered just building a tunnel underground from one to the other?
Yeah, well, it's like over an hour away. So.
That would be a long YouTube, dark YouTube series.
Yeah, our whole underground village, bunker. Yeah. It's our bunker. That's what we're getting a little stir crazy, so we're looking at bunkers now.
Cool.
It's a big process. What also keeps it interesting, it's not like building with 2x4s or even 6x6s. Like, my workshop, I build out of 6x8s. Each one of them is literally the same. And there's, you know, 96 logs in the cabin. Each one of those is different because I cut them down on the property. Mm-hmm. So this is the process.
So you built this last one out of all logs that you sourced from your property. All those beautiful 100%. Big spruce trees.
Spruce, pine,
talk about a good resource of spruce you had there.
Well, that was, we were so lucky finding that property because it was a hunting property that we bought. And then it's like, okay, need to build this cabin because we had the issues at the old cabin and had to sell that property or had to leave that property. Fortunately, we already had this place. So I looked at it from a new perspective. Okay, this is not just hunting property. Now, what are the tree resource now? What became more important for this phase of the homestead, at least, that I took a look around. Well, here's another thing. The other cabin, the first cabin, was 6-inch cedar fence posts is what I built it out of. So I'm looking, okay, I'd like to build with bigger logs so that two things.
Ideally not heavier, but bigger is heavier.
Yeah. Well, you get, so wood is a, soft wood has an R value of about 1.4 per inch. Okay. So in the middle of that 6-inch log, you're at 8.4 R value. It's a little bit different than that wall.
Like and what's right, is 8.4 R value good?
Well, your walls right here are going to be six inch, 2x6s, which are 5.5, but with pink.
And R value, just so people understand, is the insulation.
Thermal resistance. So that's the insulation. So that's what separates the cold from the warm. Mm-hmm. So in your house, our code in Ontario is to have R20 in the walls. Mm-hmm. And if you can get more than that, better. And then on the roof, it's more because heat rises. So at 8.4, we're already less than half of the R value of a standard, modern home.
So it doesn't insulate as well.
Doesn't insulate as well. But that's, keep in mind also that round, the logs meet at zero.
That's the bad spot.
Yeah. So there you need to insulate, which is why you typically see a wide grout line in the logs. Yeah. Yeah. That's insulated typically. In my case, I use moss. And then you have something to make it weatherproof on the outside. So that increases the R value right there. So I wanted bigger logs this time. So if I could average, say, even 10 inches, then I have over 30% more, over 50% more, sorry, of R value. But I started looking for logs that size.
Yeah.
There was a forest fire went through that property. I say between 85 and 100 years old because I cut the trees down and you could count 85 rings, growth rings in the trees.
So pretty good way to tell.
Yeah, and you'd have saplings. There's probably some rings in there I couldn't count. They were too small. So let's assume like 90 years ago there was a fire. So that means almost all the trees on the property are 90 years old exactly. Mm-hmm. A spruce tree and a pine tree in sandy, wet, acidic conditions.
So what you're saying grows, is that now you have trees that are the same size to build.
Same size. Yeah, that's amazing. So if you look at boreal forest fires that you, especially last year, heard about like all across the north and in Canada especially, that creates an even age forest. So the whole forest gets wiped out, then the whole forest regenerates at the same time. So you get all of the trees basically the same size. It's subject to then little micro differences in the
And so you're cutting these trees. You're not just having a bunch of logs. You're cutting, you're limbing them, you're hauling them. So what do you tell yourself? Like when, you know, I remember when we were working on that longhouse project. And look, I'm not lazy. You know, I might have more go than others. But I remember you saying, okay, let's just finish this last part off. And I remember being like, man, I'm kind of like, I'm sort of over this today, like Miller time or whatever. And you're just going at it. Like, what do you tell yourself? Is there anything? Are you like David Goggins where you're like, I realize it was my inner bitch talking to me. And I said, get your ass out there. Or are you nicer to yourself? Or how do you, what do you say? What's the inner voice tell you that you're going to get back there? And no matter what, you're going to get out there and bang off this thing. Because I think that's, you know, the cabin is just like, I'm talking about like, it's like a metaphor here for a lot of things that people don't want to take on, especially by themselves. Wow. And then what's that? And they tell themselves, me, I tell myself, I'm never going to finish this. It's too hard. But you have to be doing something that your average person isn't doing.
I mean, one of the jokes, the cliches is how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is, of course, one bite at a time.
Right. And that's how I look at a portage too.
You have to.
And I didn't always look at big difference.
Good. Well, that's a good, that's a great analogy because I look at portages with more disdain than the repeated log move.
Right.
Well, I guess
they are more miserable. You
know? They are miserable. I guess there's a similarity in getting the logs out of the forest.
Right.
So to go back to that process quickly, like the average log ended up because of this age structure ended up, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to cut these trees down and I'll use the top portion because it's going to be smaller so that I can actually manhandle them.
Right.
But what I found is that when I cut them down at this point, they were the straightest portion was the thickest portion of the tree, which is the stump up. So the butt of the tree, I ended up with an average butt diameter of, I think, 16 inches and then a narrow and small end of 10 inches. So over about 13 inches average.
So you stagger them though, right?
Then you stagger them back and forth to make up those differences. But each log ended up being then several hundred pounds, sometimes like 800 pounds for a log. And I have to now get those out of the bush. But I think what, so that process, so when you think you're an outdoorsman and you know, the love for nature and you would, like you would go out similar to me probably and look at every tree as a sort of a special resource. Like when you're cutting firewood down, even when you're camping or canoe tripping.
Yeah.
Everything's so organic that everything is unique. So every single one of the logs that went in the cabin has its own character. And I got to pull this log out, peel the bark off of it and look at it and see the character. Where do I want that in the cabin? Where do I want to, I know I'm going to be sitting right here because I've got this vision in my mind, how, what this cabin's going to look like when it's done. I know my fireplace is going to be there. I'm going to be sitting here. What do I want those logs to look like right next to me?
Right.
I don't want an ugly thing or, you know, so
I don't want D plus J hard around it there.
Yeah, yeah.
Some kids did,
right?
However many years ago.
Yeah. So that's what makes it interesting. So it makes the process easier when everything is interesting and organic. So the process becomes organic.
Cool. Yeah. No, I kind of never even thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense. I do have some experience building, but not like to that sort of level. But how did go back, like, how did you, what made you want to get into this? Because it's not the kind of thing that, and same thing with what I do too. I think a lot of people like the idea or they dream about it, but what made you want to go sort of all out with the outdoors lifestyle? Because, you know, it is a fact that people do have other options nowadays, right? Like most people aren't living the kind of lifestyle that you live or that I live. To say the least, and you're self-reliant, not just with your work, but with what you do. What did you start with a love of the outdoors and a love of nature and, you know, fishing, hunting, camping, or did it start with wanting to be self-reliant, or do you remember?
Yeah, I can definitely remember. This has been linear for me.
Yeah.
I go right back to like my grandparents had campers up in relatively this area. We'd go up and visit on the weekend and I'd learned to fish.
Yeah.
But we also lived in a small town north of Toronto and I could walk into the neighboring township into forests that hadn't been developed yet. They're subdivisions now.
But now it's crazy. Yeah. Tori's from the same town as you. I mean, it's still not Toronto or a big city.
Well, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the amount of development, man, that must be sad for you to go back there. Eh?
It's that one piece of parcel happens to still be there. And there's which is really weird because it's full of mansions all around it. And it's one sliver. So I would go there and I think probably 10 years old, I was sleeping in forts that I built out there.
Just from your back door, basically.
Yeah, basically. Probably a mile from the house, maybe 2 miles.
Now they're called bushcraft shelters.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, yeah, I could. Yeah, I wish I'd filmed it.
Anymore. It's just huge YouTube phenom.
I think our best one was we took down me and a buddy took down an old cedar rail fence and made a structure out of it. And we would just light the things on fire basically to keep us warm at night because we'd almost freeze. So the passion goes back then. But my mother got me a book called Two Little Savages written by Ernest Thompson Seton.
Extremely politically correct for today's world.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's probably banned actually, I would imagine.
Maybe, yeah. Or they changed the title.
Yeah. 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 Well, no, I bet it's actually banned.
That's maybe.
So he was one of the founders with.
They didn't ban Huck Finn, and there's all these animals.
Oh, they haven't yet.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
it's literature.
Well, it's on its way. I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, well, anyway, he was he founded the Scouts movement with Baden Powell. In the U.S. So, but anyway, he lived in Toronto, and his stories. That story was actually about a borough just north of Toronto, so it was very similar to where I was growing up. And they were building shanties and little trapping things and hunting things. So I literally was emulating
that
book.
What year was that? Was that supposed to be that book take place?
Would that be the 30s or the 40s?
Yeah.
20s, okay. 20s, okay. 30s,
so 40s, very, very different. Like Toronto would have been.
Oh, what's
like? It would have been like the Don Valley was all farmland, and people were trapping just like where Steeles is in Toronto, which is like the northern limit of the city now, would have been like wilderness.
Yeah. They literally thought it was in the middle of nowhere. I was born down there, and at my first year, I lived in a house on Cummer Avenue in Willowdale, which was considered country at the time. And my grandfather was got a house, one of the war homes. So after the war, they built these small homes.
Blows me away.
Middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
and that's downtown Toronto now, basically.
Yeah, crazy, man. Crazy.
Yeah. So I just emulated that, and then I building these shelters and sleeping in them, and then I never grew up, I guess. I just kept building shelters, including my first property at 17, and then next property I had.
You bought your first property at 17.
Yeah.
So that was the one that was around here,
on
Whitestone Lake.
Well, so not the one that you know of, but on that lake, on the south end of the lake, though, south of this highway. Like, it's neat that Jim's here now. So on the south side of that highway, I would leave my boat at the marina there and boat down or canoe down, depending on when it was, to a 2.5-acre parcel on a bigger island in the south end of that lake. And I built just a little stick frame cabin, no outhouse or anything, literally just a fire, which I lit the whole island on fire by accident. I had a gas can, I lit a fire and I poured gas on it like every stupid 17-year-old does.
Yeah,
And the whole, I just threw it in the air and it spread and all the hemlocks caught on fire.
What did you do? Did you just bail and like cook some marshmallows on it from your boat or?
Pails of water and just like for probably the entire day to put it out because it's all underground fire.
Right.
It was so scary. So yeah, that was my first. I bought that working in construction. I was making really good money in construction in the summer when I was 17 and my parents helped me
put that together.
You weren't really really great in school, were you?
Horrible. No, I was. I didn't graduate. I went for the full 4 years, but I didn't. I couldn't.
You did eventually learn how to read and things, though, right?
I haven't yet, but I'm working on it.
No, but you weren't look. That's kind of like me too. I wasn't the school guy. I don't have like a lot of people ask you to get into writing these articles, to get into this. Did you go to film school? Did you take writing courses in university? But you're kind of the same in a lot of the ways that you
learned. Well, my first success, if you call it that, on social media was on Facebook because I started writing articles for Ontario Tourism and others. And one of my posts was, look, here's the, I dropped out of, I literally didn't get my diploma because I failed grade 11 and 12 English twice each. So I only have my grade 10 English and then I become a writer for paddling magazines and tourism.
I didn't do well in English either, but I always crushed the creative writing segment.
I did fine on those things, but I did the 30 or 40% of the mark was to do a presentation in front of the class, and I was so shy.
Were you?
Yeah, I literally would not do it. So that's 40% of the mark gone.
Yeah.
So I would get 49% in the course each year. So.
No kidding.
Yeah.
But you certainly don't seem to have overcome that now. You're doing a podcast.
I'm still an introvert. I can get behind a camera, but in person, I don't have a big social circle and we don't socialize much. Like we are definitely still, my wife and I, introverts.
You make a special exception for me, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not intimidating at all, I guess.
This loser, no problem being with now. Yeah, so.
No, I like people and that are real, but also where I can be real and I can be real and it's in natural situations. But mind you, like I built a business and we had over 90 employees at one point before we got wiped out by the financial crisis. I won business awards. I could get up in front of the Chamber of Commerce and accept awards.
Yeah. What business was that?
Commercial roofing, sheet metal, but also rooftop solar installations, solar energy.
So how much did that background help you? Like you're not building cabins. You have some idea, you know how to use your hands, you know, have a construction background, but that's not cabin building. Was it like that much of a jump to get? So like, okay, so you're young, you read this book, you get into the outdoors, you want more. Something triggers you, like, I need to go deeper. And then at what point were you like, okay, well, I want to like at what point along the line were you like, I got to, you know, try this building a cabin and living the life, living in the woods. Was that always part of the dream or?
You know, I don't publicly say this, and it's a little bit offensive maybe to people that are in modern homesteading, but homesteading in the past meant you were granted a piece of property here. Like this was a homesteading area. Like these were grants. They gave you 100 acres and you had to clear that forest and build a place
right.
within a certain amount of time in order to be given title, granted title.
Yeah.
So that to me is what homesteading means. It doesn't mean buying a house and raising a couple of chickens or planting a garden, right? That's just life.
Right.
And I'm not insulting people that call it homesteading. I'm just saying that was the original and the real.
That's where the word derived from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So when I got, so I read Henry David Thoreau as a teenager during this period where I'm failing English and not functioning and not being functioning very well in society. So I wanted out.
Right.
So I read that book and some of Emerson's books, including Self-Reliance. And I got in my head, I was going to do that. So I bought this, I sold that first property and bought a 5.5 acre parcel with my sister and we thought we'd divide it up, but she ended up, just disappearing basically. And I took complete ownership of that property. Yeah. I built a log cabin on it.
Okay.
And that was
in this area too, right?
Yeah. That was up on the lake where you're talking
about.
Okay. So I sold the island property at a profit, and with that profit built the next one.
Right. And how old were you at this time?
I'd be 19.
Yeah. Isn't that funny that how many 19-year-olds are building cabins, buying property?
Yeah.
And you didn't even graduate high school.
No. And
at
I did.
This point. So
no.
Were you still in high school at this point?
No. So at 18, I finished.
You finished.
Okay. And then I got a summer job.
So you never did your grade 13 then? Or you did?
No. Because, I would have had to make up first of all, the 4 credits.
Yeah.
And then the others. And I was on a path for university. Like I was smart enough to go to university and I took all the advanced courses that you needed to get into university.
But it's not only just smart. There's also like you have to, there's different kinds of smarts. There's people that are very smart that might not have gone to university that still have an education, right? Like I think so much emphasis gets put on formal education and everyone's saying you have to have an education. To people that means formal education only. But I think the point is education in general. Sure, if you want to do something like you want to be a doctor, or something, you have to have that. There's no working around it, and that's probably a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot to be said for just teaching yourself stuff, especially if it's something like you or I end up doing. What would I even have gone to school for? For what would necessarily have you gone to school for at the time?
Mm-hmm.
YouTube didn't even exist. Nobody was teaching self-reliant skills. There was outdoor ed courses, but that's more teaching people how to run like a guiding business. And I just look back and I'm like, if I had gone to school, maybe taken a bunch of Ritalin or whatever they're giving kids like me at the time, I might have gotten this diploma or university degree and I might have been stuck in something that wasn't really true to me.
Well, if you were an outdoorsman back then, you would say, I want to do forestry or more. Almost every outdoorsman would say, I want to be a conservation officer.
Right.
That was sort of the cliche thing. And you went to Sir Sanford Fleming or to, I thought I'll go to college for environmental technologies, but I get down to London. I actually moved down there and I'm enrolled at Fanshawe College and realize, first of all, I ended up not qualifying for the OSAP, I think it was called.
Yeah, student loans.
Yeah, so I didn't get funding. I hadn't put enough money away. And the program was basically like lab work. Mm-hmm. So here I'm thinking, environment was in the title, right? So I'm going to do this environmental studies thing. Mm-hmm. And it's sitting in a lab analyzing like chemical composition of pollution or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, noble maybe, but
it sounds like...
I would have done horribly in it because if it didn't interest me, I wasn't going to put the work.
You know, I remember sitting down one time and I was probably about 22 years old and I just paddled the Nahanni River, a self-guided trip on the South Nahanni River. My brother and a couple friends came along and, this was expensive for us at the time. It was a pretty big kind of expeditionary trip. People usually take guides when they do stuff like that. They're like retired doctors. And I remember sitting down with somebody who was in an outdoor ed course in, Laurentian or something like that. And she's telling me I'm crazy, that I shouldn't be doing this and that it's too dangerous. And I'm like, so what you did is you went to university to learn to not even go outdoors. right? I mean, not to knock that, like Kai and Dave Maroney went to Laurentian, they own Lure of the North that we were talking about in your podcast, who are like epic freaking individuals, right? Running the business, they do a little YouTube, they live this, you know, lifestyle pretty close to nature for sure, much, you know, off the roads and all that. And they did that too. But I just wonder, you know, she went and heard how scary it was to do all these things and all the dangers in school. I figured out those dangers and I learned how on my own time that I could deal with all those dangers, you know, plan for the best and hope for the best and plan for the worst. Is that what plan for the worst and hope for the best. Make sure you don't mess that one up. Right. And, you know, and so I kind of learned that. And there I was up there doing it and this person was still learning about it. Right.
Yeah. Well, learning the cautious thing. That's the problem with formal education in school now. It's all more liability concerns now than anything. Right. So it's how do you avoid hurting somebody? But when you're taking it on yourself, then you're going to take more risk and you're not as beholden to other people. So, that's a different path. I think self-directed people would choose just to, the school of hard knocks or whatever, like you're going to do real things.
I think that's kind of the way I took it getting into what I'm doing. But speaking of cool jobs, when I was on the Nahanni River, there's these outpost cabins that rangers got to stay in and they were allowed to stay for 2 weeks at a time and they could bring a friend who didn't have to necessarily work for Parks Canada. Yeah. So that when, you know, so when I did it, I was 22 and the guy I was doing the trip with, a buddy of mine, I won't mention his names, the two park rangers were these attractive, you know, lesbians couple. And he was like really excited about that. And, you know what I mean? Here we are in the wilderness getting landed in the place. He's like, Jim, there's these hot lesbians up there. And anyways, this is the last thing he was expecting to find in the middle of the wilderness. And I'm like, calm down, buddy, calm down. You know, but anyways, I just, that would be cool. That would be a cool gig. And I've seen there's like three or four, I think there's three stations along there. So if you work for the park, you get a 2 week stay. You have to actually, like, you're not just staying and, you know, writing like Thoreau or doing Group of Seven paintings. You're, when people come in, you're guiding, you're leading hikes, you're actually doing stuff. But I was thinking at the time, I'm like, man, this would be a great,
great job. Well, when I went up to Dick Prenicke's cabin in Alaska, same thing. There was a girl that was stationed there for 2 months in the summer, and that was her job, just to live in the cabin next to it, in one of the historic cabins, which is pretty cool job.
I think that's cool. Like if you want to do something like that, I even what you and I do too, it's a lot of work. You know what I mean? Like it is a lot of work.
This is not the easy path. Like you don't choose entrepreneurship anyway. You do it to be self-directed. But I think in my case, I can speak for me because I shouldn't say that I'm only entrepreneurial and can't sit down and do something, because I functioned fine when I ended up getting a job. And really my work ethic when I came out of the woods finally, it was 21 actually when I got a job and started my trade, sheet metal.
Right.
When I started that, I did well enough that I kept getting promoted to the point where I was managing a big operation.
Yeah.
And then I started my own business and then did well on that. Yeah. And then, you know, kept going. But when I finally decided to get out of the corporate world, I actually sold my business, which at that point we had diluted it down to 11% ownership. But we sold it at a high enough amount that I could put enough money in my pocket that I could pay off all that debt that I accumulated when I lost my business, and then also have a couple of years where I could figure out what I wanted to do. And that was the creation of my Self-Reliance brand. So I created it without knowing how to turn it into income. But that came 2 or 3 years later, just organically without really a plan. But I turned down offers to work in the public company that bought us out. I actually could have had a very successful corporate career as an executive, and I turned that down because I knew I can't keep doing things just for money. And my kids were getting older, and I could afford them to not do things just to bring enough money to raise the family. I could focus on what would bring me happy and make me a better husband and father anyway by doing something I like to do. So I just walked away from all of it. I tried to sell my shares. I kept getting promoted back to the president of this company that we all ended up being partners in, and I would quit. And then I would have, we would have another investor come in and they would insist that I was the president. So it was actually functioning very well in
right.
that circle.
Yeah.
Like on boardrooms on Bay Street in right. Toronto Financial District. And but to me, I'd be sitting there in my suit and tie across from yeah. like the richest people in the country, literally yeah. trying to buy us wow. out. And I'm negotiating these deals and I'm like going home and stripping it all off and going in the backyard and planting a garden. Like,
right.
like
right.
my head wasn't in that space.
Right.
So to get back to this and find out I could just do what I love to do and it turned into something that made enough money to.
So would you say, so what you're saying essentially is that you gave away, and this is very much your video, one of your videos that has done extremely well, is it starts with you walking through a big city in the corporate world, and then it basically fades to you, you know, carrying logs over your shoulders, building a cabin in the wilderness. So, you know, most people don't think of that kind of lifestyle. You think that you'd have to leave everything behind. And not care about money and just be, you know, like a recalcitrant essentially or something like that.
Well, that's what I was when I was 19.
Right, right, right.
So that yeah. is where it started. That's right. So I kind of have the full mm. breadth of mm. experience when people say, oh, you're not poor, so you don't know. Yeah. And you don't. I told this story just recently too. When I moved to that yeah. property, I had a bicycle yeah. and a story I've never told. Actually, I keep meaning to is that when I was 19, I actually got during that period, I'd bought that property and I didn't move until I was 21, actually. So I bought that property when I was 19 with money I was making as a courier down in Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah. So for a year and a half, I was a courier. So I bought a car to be this car courier to make it.
So you know how to drive in downtown Toronto?
Yeah, I was.
That's not something a lot of people from that live up north can say.
No, and it was high pressure.
Crazy, man.
Yo, yeah. It was insane. Yeah. And that was year round. So I, you know, dealing with this, you know, it's all the conditions, but just picturing myself now there gives me anxiety, but yeah. it was just so out of character. But while I was there, I lost focus and I started just like hunting and kind of moved into the archery club and then just stopped going into work. So I didn't have income. So I stopped paying my insurance on the car and I'm driving to a hunting spot and car accident, a car comes whipping through an intersection at 80 or 100 kilometers an hour, back in somebody else. They spin into me, smash my car up, put me in the hospital just for the day. And then the car was written off and no fault insurance had just come in. So because I didn't have insurance, the car was written off. So I still owed over $10,000 on that car.
Yeah. So you owed over 10 grand.
Yeah. So that wiped me out again. That was my first wipeout of my life.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So here I am. So then I move up. That's why I had to sell that island property. Mm-hmm. So it kind of worked again, similar to this situation.
I suppose the timber rights weren't worth much on that island property. No. You burned it down.
Yeah. It was charred wood now. So it lasts longer.
Pre-cleared island. Lots of firewood.
That was insane. Yeah. That's just foolish young typical guy, right? So I made all these mistakes.
So could you say though that you had the corporate life, but then you said, I don't care about money. And you started leading your, and I don't care about money. And you started following your passions. Yeah. Would you say that, I mean, if you don't mind me asking, that you made as much in the end or more following your passions because you found a way to monetize it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And definitely making more money now than I made.
Yeah.
At the peak of my career. Yeah.
That's the dream, man.
And people.
That's the dream.
Yeah. So I saw a comment actually on a video today saying, I did some research. I know how much money you're making. You don't need this, or you're not struggling or whatever. You won't be. I don't know why you're worried about the future and all this. I look at YouTube basically as an athlete's career. You're going to make pretty good money or really good money for a short period of time. Yeah. But you're going to burn out or you're going to become obsolete. No, it's just the fact. Well,
it's like, what do? You start a podcast maybe?
Yeah. So you have to be nimble. It's an entrepreneur. You go, you do what you have to do. And if you're fortunate, you get to stay within your passion still in your genre. And for us sitting here talking, we're still talking about self-reliance and outdoors. Mm-hmm. So it's still.
And I think that's what, for me, that's what I think is inspiring people, you know, too, is that you didn't care specifically about the path of to make money. You just started following your passion. And when you followed your passion, look at what you actually ended up doing better anyways, even though it wasn't your point. Like, this is the kind of stuff that people are explaining and like self-help videos and stuff. You actually lived that.
And you can't, know
what I mean? But people don't have the guts to try it.
That's the thing. But keep reading those books. Like, I've read self-help books my entire life, you know, from literally that kind of self-help to financial help. And that's how I got into real estate.
Education, though.
Yeah, education. Yeah. I got into real estate because I was reading real estate investment books during that period when I should have been studying other things, which is how I thought to buy the property. And the second property was purchased with the intent of dividing it into three parcels so that we could sell one and he keep one each. Mm-hmm. So I was already thinking, doing the education, learning that business lesson and then trying to
so would you say that's a big and then trying to turn it into spending more time in the bush essentially.
So then back to what I said about the homesteading. Yeah. So now I'm so broke. Yeah. I'm at this place with just a bicycle and a golden retriever and a 12 gauge shotgun, thinking I'm going to live off the land. Now, fortunately, I brought
have a horse. You said
a bicycle. Yeah. And a bag of rice and a couple of cases of tuna. And that's what I thought I'd live off the land. But so I'm so broke that building a log cabin to answer that question. Yeah. What it cost nothing. Like basically my dad would bring up a chainsaw from work. He didn't own one either and lend it to me. But other than that, I had a handsaw and an axe. Yeah. And I had to build that first cabin with that and some scrounged materials that he would bring up if I needed nails or something. Yeah. So that was out of necessity.
Yeah. Yeah. So you kind of had to do it.
Necessity. Which is that's what the homesteaders did. They started off by building a log home quickly with some neighbors to on a parcel like
this. Or sawed even out west, can you imagine?
Or sawed, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, and that was temporary until you could build a proper house for your family. So that to me is what this homesteading has been. Now I've done it three times on three different properties. I've built log cabins to become a self-sufficient homesteader. And all of the periphery, all the infrastructure around the cabin becomes the homestead and the life. So you got the gardens and the water system and the energy system and all the things I mentioned, food storage. So that's what I've been working on diligently because I'm so serious now about homesteading and being able to walk away from society if necessary and still thrive, which was even while I was working, that was always my goal, is to reduce my living expenses to as low as possible. I could lose my job. That's what we learned from the 2010 loss of our business.
Right.
I need to have my life set up in a way that if I lose my job or something else happens, like the lockdowns 4 years ago, that doesn't impact me.
That you're not totally screwed.
Yeah, I'm not wiped out.
So how does that feel? How does it feel to say, okay, I have enough food for my whole family, even if kind of, you know, society crumbles?
It feels
whether it happens or not. Do you think, does it feel?
Well, there will be little things, even if there's no crisis event, major crisis event. Of course, there's going to be recessions and depressions and
just losing your job.
Yeah, losing your job. Power outages. We're in an area here. We have unreliable power. We're likely to lose power from this storm maybe tomorrow even if it's just a few hours, right?
And I'd almost feel like, well, I guess first of all, It sounds to me like there is a level of definitely education needed, but also a level of just some guts and taking that jump to live that self-reliant lifestyle, which has to be motivated by something more than just money to live what your passion and to become self-reliant. It sounds like to me, that's like, you know, you had to do it sort of, but it really took some guts to go out there and do it.
You have to be Well, the thing is, then you'll see this in these self-help books too. You'll define risk, especially entrepreneur books, like A Rich Dad, Poor Dad, for example, with the quadrant, whatever he calls it. Basically, you have an employee, a business owner, an investor, and so on. You discover when you lose your job or you lose your business that neither of them were secure, real secure. You can get fired or laid off tomorrow. It's because of things outside of your control. So by taking responsibility for every aspect of your life, including your income, makes you less vulnerable, more resilient. So by learning skills beyond what you just learned as, say, I don't know, even if it's a higher end skilled trade, like a plumber, you learn just plumbing. Well, if the plumbing market's down, you don't have the skills to go and do something else. Maybe it's finance. Maybe you need to become a computer analyst or something, which is you know, the fields that actually have work in them right now. So
the ability to learn new things.
Yeah, the ability to learn new things, to take risks, to diversify, to learn well. Like, don't get so comfortable where you are that you stop learning new things.
Yeah. And do you think that's something to be scared of or something to be excited about?
I was always totally excited, right. But I couldn't wait to learn the next thing. And
yeah.
I didn't know that building a cabin when I was 19 or 21, mm-hmm. when I built the first actual log cabin, proper log cabin, I didn't know that skill would come in to Andy at 45.
Yeah. Who knew that being a pioneer was going to cash in 2022 or whatever, man?
Right.
Yeah. Isn't that awesome? And so, okay, well, how would you, somebody that's got like these, you know, what people call homesteading or these self-reliance, living close to nature, you know, you're definitely, you know, showing people how it can be done. You know what I mean? How would you look at something like that compared to more raw survival skills? You know what I mean? Do you, you know, people talk about wilderness living. So you hear the thing, there's survival and then there's wilderness living, which is kind of like long-term survival where you're actually not just waiting for a resupply, you know, like in a military perspective or waiting to be rescued. But you're kind of living out there in a much more like, you know, like in a shelter kind of thing. And then there's what you're doing, which is like real, like, you know, upper scale wilderness living. How would you, like, does somebody like you look at survival, like what you'd see on Alone, and think that's not possible? Do you practice those skills, or is it something that you learn in case everything else goes wrong? Like, how would you compare those things?
You know, there's like an Alaskan wilderness homesteader or wilderness survivalist even that builds a cabin and lives there. His skills, especially if he's done it full time, and especially from a younger age with lots of energy, mm-hmm. learns a lot about survival and living off the land. Mm-hmm. Where because I was kind of pushed, not pushed or pulled or whatever you would say, I lived this modern life for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. I was still doing all of the things. I was still canoeing, fishing, hunting, and doing that.
Yeah.
I lived in a village of 900 people and drove 2 hours to my job in the city because that was more important to me than reducing my drive time.
Yeah.
So I was able to still do the things, but not at the level that I'm doing it now or that somebody that had always been doing it full time. Mm-hmm. So the survival skill part of it, I learned that from that 10 years old or 8 years old or whatever.
That's kind of where you started.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. I literally started there. Yeah. And 21 with the shotgun and a fishing rod, mm-hmm. living at that cabin property with my golden retriever back then. That was my first foray into what was called survival. You know, I had to learn how to start a fire without a lighter. I had to collect the firewood with just hand tools.
And hunt for some food, hunt and fish for food too.
Fish for food.
What were you eating? Like, what were you hunting mostly in those days?
Ducks. I had no big game success at that time. I didn't shoot my first big game animal until I was, I guess, 21. Later that year, I got a bear. That was my first big game animal, but mostly small game. Grouse, ducks.
Was it a 12 fish. Gauge or a 20 gauge? 12 gauge, yeah. So good amount of waterfowl.
Lots of waterfowl.
What's the craziest thing you've ever eaten while you're on?
That during that period, porcupine.
Yeah.
Raccoons, several, because that was.
Raccoon,
Oh, yeah.
How was that?
It was all the same.
No kidding. So when I was just up in the Yukon, I was hanging out in Mayo, and this guy's dog. So after my big trip, I just came down the Heart River, and I was hanging out with these guys, and a couple of them recognized me. They watched my YouTube videos. So they end up kind of turns into a bit of a party there, and this guy's dog gets quilled by a porcupine. And I said, well, I'll go find it. And they said, well, you're probably not going to be able to find it. Well, sure enough, I did. And it was hiding in this like culvert the guy had cached in the woods. And so he came and dispatched it because apparently it was causing all kinds of problems and quilling his dogs. So everybody's saying, well, let's eat it. If we're going to kill this thing, we should eat it. But nobody knew what to do. So the one girl said, well, I let's call this elder, this indigenous elder over to show us how it's done, because I've heard you burn them off in the fire. So sure enough, you do, but we just didn't know, do you gut it or then do you burn it off? So we had a big fire and we burnt all the quills off and we use sticks to move them in and then rub the quills off like this with a stick, mm-hmm. you know, and it's almost like hair. The quills are almost like a hair. So it doesn't smell very good, But then we gutted it all and boiled it in like a big turkey boiler. Pretty good, man. The guy said don't eat too much of the fatty meat. Of the really fatty meat, or maybe it could give you an upset stomach because it's super rich.
Yeah, I guess.
But first of all, I was super hungry, and it almost just looked like a big, like a chicken breast, yeah. Like that. And yeah, I thought it was pretty tasty.
It's perfectly fine. Yeah. Like I had a little cook stove like I have now, a wood cook stove in that cabin, and yeah. We would go out hunting for the day and just stick a bear roast in there, or stick a raccoon, or stick a porcupine in that and go. Yeah. But even before the cabin was built and I was eating raccoons and porcupines, I would build a smoky fire in the field and just leave it over the smoky fire. So it was basically jerky by the end of the day.
Yeah, no, you do. You still are up on that good slow cooking, that all day slow cook. I started doing that because of you. I'm always like, it's time to cook. Let's do it. You're like, let's just leave it here and let it go. And when you're doing a big, some of those roasts you're doing,
Lots of flavor. What's interesting, they're eating porcupines and raccoons. Yeah. So my wife and I went and visited the old cabin about 5 years ago now. Yeah. And an old couple had bought it from me. I didn't realize they still owned it after all these years. Yeah. And they built a house there. And they still have my dog's grave. I buried my dog there and made a little cross with Toby written across it in black, rust paint. And they've kept it up. It's literally still there.
See, they must have been good people.
Yeah, they're very good people. Yeah. And they preserve the cabin even, like they store stuff in it. So I was able to see it 25 years later. But what was funny?
It was still standing. That's
still standing. And it was just built on the ground. Yeah. But he said, we thought this was funny. If you walk around the property, even right now, you'll find arrows stuck in the trees in several places because we were always shooting up at the raccoons and the porcupines.
That's wild.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, you got to. So all the survival stuff. I mean, that was just being young, and you learn a lot when you're young because you just make mistakes and you just go. Mm-hmm. We would just walk for miles. Like we ended up shooting my first bull moose with a bow there, mm-hmm. like just walking through the woods and hunting and just figuring it out as we went, and then doing the hard work, like hauling it across hills and across lakes and with a canoe and like loaded down doing it till 3 a.m.
Well, I noticed typically when I go fishing with you, you seem to catch a lot of more fish than me. I don't know whether, you know, like sometimes it's just luck, but I'm like, he's got to be doing something. I don't think I'm a bad fisherman. I think maybe I had a couple bad days.
No, you do well enough.
Yeah, I think that maybe the last time I did better than you. Yeah. You're just like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, I got beat by everybody on that last trip.
Yeah, so sometimes.
That was just me saying, oh, it's their turn.
You're just being nice.
Yeah.
But no, I definitely see that you definitely have that ability.
Yeah, I think that ties into your question about survival, whether I look at that as a separate skill or whether it's the same. To me, simple organic living and living in nature, it's all connected. And the gardening to me has always been very interesting. I've been gardening since I was a teenager in my parents' backyard, growing my own food without them doing it. I just started on my own because I love the, you know, stick a seed in the ground, you add, you know, fuel or water and good soil and everything. You see this thing grow.
So cool.
Well, the next step is that an animal comes and eats that. Right. And I harvest the animal. Like it's so connected, right?
Right,
like,
right.
You learn one thing. You learn how to cut a tree down and turn it into fuel or building materials. To me, is the same as hunting or fishing or gardening.
I forget there's some legendary native leader who recommended just planting a seed and trying to grow something to get a connection to the world. And it's funny that you brought this up in the whole realm of sort of the survival aspect of things is because I think that growing food is one of those things you never hear about. Mm-hmm. Like you read these survival manuals. And then in these wilderness living manuals, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, like we talked about, wilderness living is sort of like long-term survival. You know, you're not in a cabin.
But how many wilderness living stories have you ever read where they didn't have like bags of not rice, but flour salt pork.
Right.
They always had the things they brought with them and they supplemented with fish and game.
Right. And you look at, right, exactly. And you look at like the people like the Montagne Innu, like in northern Quebec, they migrated thousands of kilometers. Like they'd go all the way up rivers in the winter. They'd spend time like on the Haida-Land caribou hunting. They'd build canoes, run the river back down, net salmon at the mouth of the river.
The Cree and the Mississippi, though.
They felt that they were, you know, I think they even used the word superior to farming natives. Absolutely. Because they felt like they were freer.
People, you know what I mean? Throughout humanity, many cultures were way healthier when they were nomadic.
But they also felt, once we started farming, human health kind of eventually went down because our diet.
Well, that's when politics came in. There's a lot of things that went downhill when we became agriculturists.
Right, right.
Staying in one spot and degrading the land. Like in the past, you left areas fallow and you moved with the fishing game.
Yeah, but I think what I'm trying to get at too is that I feel like, also, though, at the same time, when it comes to these books on wilderness living, somehow, you see that they have the supplies. You see how they have this and that. If they're not really living nomadically in most places, like the Arawak, for example, that lived in Jamaica, they had a pretty good man. Like they weren't nomadic. They more or less stayed in one place. They did some farming, beautiful weather. Jamaica doesn't even get bad hurricanes as bad because the elevation, fish and all that. But for the most part, none of those books talk about the fact that really to sustain here long term, if you're going to more or less be living in one spot, I feel like growing plants is important. None of those books really ever talk about it.
No, the problem is, of course, history is written by colonists for the most part, right? So, but there's a lot of information coming out now. And Dan Flores is his name, I think. The author, he wrote a book about how humans have essentially moved around the world to places that had ignorant game, essentially ignorant animals, so that we could harvest them.
Yeah.
And we survived and grew bigger brains and more muscle and everything off of the meat that we were able to harvest from basically ignorant or stupid, naive animals.
This is how I got into the outdoors. It's going to places where there's ignorant game.
That's
and more
I know. I think we literally said this the very first time we met that the instigation or the reason behind the canoe trips and the wilderness trips is sort of that.
Yeah. We're looking at a map of me and my brother where we, you know, grew up and spent tons of time east of Bancroft, and we say, here's our main lake. It's a water access lake. Fishing's pretty good, but man, if we get into that lake, I bet it's good. I bet you there is some really ignorant fishing.
Yeah.
Like we weren't saying that, right? But that's how we learned to portage and how we could camp is because we could get into places where the fish hadn't seen lures as much, where they weren't pressured as much, where they weren't so scared of this and that, and where we just load in.
I've always been that way. That's how I got into outdoor or backcountry trips was exactly for that reason. And I've always taken another step in every single point of land I see on water. It's like, that's a good spot for a cabin, for a homestead.
Right.
And then I can fish and hunt the area around that. So it's definitely all tied together.
Well, I even look at this year where, you know, I did a bunch of scouting because we wanted to deer hunt right around our area. And, you know, we did some scouting and it kind of told us where not to go because we saw, okay, this is close to my house, close to a road, but easier access. Well, there's more people there. You know, had been hunted by this group of people for many, many years. We did a little bit of extra work. And to be honest with you, it was more fun and ended up getting like a bigger deer than, you know, and having a lot more action. We didn't get a ton of deer, but we had a great hunt just because we were just a little bit deeper into where people usually don't go. And of course, there's stories that could go either way with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I think, and you know, we were talking about this a bit in your podcast too, is that I feel like it's a lot of work too. And you know, to get up and get outdoors sometimes, like once you're out there, it's good, but man, you got to find your fishing rod and where is it? Like, let's be honest with you. A lot of outdoorsmen, they're not that organized. Long trips come to that. It's very, it feels great to see. I remember a guy I was doing a trip with, he pulled up and he opened his door and like an entire tackle box jumped out of my driveway. And he's just like, you know what I mean? I'm like, but once you do that work and you get out there, you're like, it's always so worth it. You know what I mean? And sometimes it takes more work to get into more remote places, but there's rewards for that.
So Dan Flores, that book I mentioned about indigenous cultures following the animals around, also was, you know, there's a lot of evidence now about how North America was cultivated very intensively by the indigenous people here, right from the north down to the south, and it was basically a big savanna that was managed with fire and just clearing and what do you call it? Like improving certain species. Like,
yeah. Well, one of the things I heard people used to do is they'd actually plant fruit trees. Yeah. Like I hear the Iroquois, like on a portage trail, they plant a fruit tree so they know, you know, the following year there's a good chance at a certain time there'd be food there to resupply.
Well, the American chestnut, where there's groves of nut, there's nut groves, big forests, swaths of forest that they know were cultivated because they have certain. Right. They can do the genetic study and figure out that the seeds actually came from this other state and were planted in these areas and cultivated for their bigger nuts or their better taste or whatever. And this is going back thousands of years. Like, it's not a modern thing. So we've always had to have, we've always had to manipulate the landscape in order to
It takes big nuts to live that lifestyle. You know what I mean? Yeah. But no, I see what you're saying. And you know what though? That stuff fascinates me. Like people are like, where do you get your inspiration from? It's like mostly people who aren't alive anymore. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like these kind of stories, indigenous people, the first people that did crazy, you know, expeditions to remote places. You know, I looked at a friend of mine that lives, Alex Mathias, that lives up in Tomogamy. He finds an arrowhead on his beach that's something like 10,000 years old. Really? They don't even know where the chariot that is made for it comes from. Wow. And, you know, like, and you find, you know, chariot and those stones that are used to make arrowheads that come from, you know, Labrador, from Rama Bay. So you have Rama chariot and it's distributed so widely because they think because it was just so cool because you'd flake it and there'd be like this cool red pattern in it, like this khaki color had this red pattern in it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people think, well, maybe it had like, if you have arrowhead, maybe it has like a little more power and maybe good luck to have this, right? Mm-hmm. But you find it in Chesapeake Bay, you find it on Lake Superior, and not one dude traveled all the way in, you know, but it made a big voyage from hand to hand, traveling through different kinds of people.
It's amazing. And of course, where are we all descended from? The survivors from back then, right? Like it was a lineage of adventurers and hardworking people and people that had whatever it took to survive and pass their genes down. We didn't. Right. We're not coming from the weak people or the uneducated or the less intelligent people or strong, less, you know, weaker people. Like
definitely not. They're not passing their genes on. I have a theory. It was like back in the day in like a hardcore like hunter gatherer society. It would be like the equivalent to professional sports nowadays. If you weren't like NHL caliber, you probably didn't make it past childhood. Mm-hmm. Then as soon as you're around the age, around 42, where you should be retiring from the NHL now, you just died. Mm-hmm. Probably because you couldn't keep up anymore. And you look at like the Thule Inuit who traveled like from Siberia through the Arctic archipelago to like Greenland, like they lived to like 42, like the Neanderthals, like 42 would be old guy.
Yeah, and if you were a badass, you were like got all these injuries and scars and broken bones.
Yeah, just like, could you imagine without like surgery and all that kind of stuff? Yeah. You know, it's like, it's wild though, man.
Yeah.
But I think, I definitely get some of my inspiration through that. But you probably get this too. Just, do you hear people like, that are just blown away by some of the things that you do that are challenging? Like, I get that. For example, I'll have some people like, you know, that I might bump into if I'm on a canoe trip, I'm doing something, I tell them what I'm doing and they're like, oh my God, you're portaging a whole kilometer? Like, good Lord. And it's like, honestly, I guess people that don't kind of read about history, that never done anything like that, I feel like some of the tasks that are like, I would consider just a fun afternoon are like the craziest thing for a lot of modern day people. Like, do you kind of get people saying that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of what we talked about on, I think on my podcast about the micro challenges and creating false hardships in order to make up for the soft lives that we generally.
Well, in modern day, in life, because you can take the easier path out. But the point is, I think, like, you know, we have safety nets in society and stuff like that. You can take the easier path out, but is the easier path really the easy path? You know what I mean? Or is it the path to be like, oh man, like, are you really going to be fulfilled, right?
Well, think about, here's a really simple analogy. You got the summit, just on like, say a typical state park, and that's an easy, relatively easy trail, and you got this really difficult trail up here.
Yeah.
You got 90% of the people taking this path here and they end up in a whole cluster of people doing exactly the same type of person as them doing the same thing. And then you have this guy, this badass couple scaling the vertical face on the north side, the north face.
Right.
Right. So then they're alone enjoying this beautiful vista. Yeah. Their reward is completely different than the masses that took this easy path. So do you want to end up in the same place as all the other people taking the easy path? Or do you want to end up with your own special reward because you put in the effort to take the path least traveled?
Right.
Like that's the way my philosophy, I always take the path of most resistance, it seems, which in some cases is foolish. But we, you know, give credit to their ancestors in this life that we've been kind of given, this society that we've been given, is a lot easier than what they had. Yeah. It was more life and death for them. We get to choose that to take a, you know, create a bit of a harder life without fatal consequences as much as it would have been in the past. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. So you would say the you know how people say take the path of least resistance. You would say maybe that's not really the best advice to follow.
No, I say take the if you want a rewarding life, I would take the path of most resistance or at least some resistance. Mm-hmm. And then the journey itself too becomes like a simple path. And the journey is not very interesting. And I guess the summit's usually not as interesting either. So yeah, I think taking the path of least resistance is the least interesting. And then it becomes the least rewarding, where I think the harder path is more interesting all the way along. So the journey is the reward, and then you also may end up with an awesome reward at the end. So
so would you say that it's necessarily the view from the mountain on that metaphor, or the path climbing up it?
Seems to be the path, because I know for myself, I'd start to lose interest in things when I reach the pinnacle.
Right. So I was going to say, when I was in Banff, I took the gondola up, and now we had Wesley with us and like on the wheelchair, so we couldn't go much further than that. But we saw the path in Banff where everybody went to this lookout, and there was like a ton of people going there. It looked pretty fun. But there was like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people
at the gondola.
Oh, you had to get you couldn't even just get on the gondola. You had to get a reservation to even go up the gondola in Banff, right? And then I bumped into these other people who had just, they got up to the top and they just walked over this way on a path over the hill and down there. I said, how many people did you see? They said, nobody. We were just hiking for 6 hours. They took the gondola up with hundreds of people. Everyone went this way. They went over this way and had a wilderness experience. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, it probably wasn't that much more challenging. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a path. There wasn't staircases. And they just came back. They got exercise. They looked totally fulfilled and happy. And I'm just like, that is me. You know what I mean? I would way rather do that than the other one all day long. You know what I mean? And there's nothing wrong if you wanted to do it the other way, but I think the real adventure to be had, to be found, is more off the beaten path, you know?
We went to our friend's 60th birthday back before Christmas, and her family was there, people we'd known but haven't seen for like 25 years probably. And they were talking about trips. My wife and Emily went on a couple of trips without me recently, the last couple of years, one to Madeira, Portugal, which is where they're from, the Azores. And they said, why aren't you doing those trips and why aren't you interested in that? I said, I go to wilderness places. I don't want to go to cities. I've been to Europe a few times and I'm not that interested in.
Look, our family moved away from there.
Like, yeah, exactly.
For a reason. Just exactly. Europe, you're awesome.
Kind of. But they said, there's too many people. They said, so you're saying you would rather not go to this specific thing and see this thing because there's the number of people that are there and you won't get that experience? And they were blown away by that concept. They couldn't understand why I would, you know, deprive myself of seeing this view or this national treasure or whatever in that country.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like, I'm not going to a place to take a photograph of it to say I was there.
Right.
The whole point of tourism and for going to beautiful places or unique places is to see that thing and immerse yourself in that experience. Well, how is there an experience with shoulder to shoulder people? You're not, what are you enjoying the nature?
I'm also, Sean, the other thing is that I couldn't agree with you more, because it also cost way more. Mm-hmm. And I just think when you have the self-reliance skills like we do, and when you've experienced these other things, you can see what we're seeing. And those things kind of seem scary to other people. And then when you go back and you do that kind of, you know, travel, like, you know, like the path on the gondola or going somewhere like that, you're just like, it's so unfulfilling. Mm-hmm. You almost feel like a little ripped off even. Right. You know, and that's how me and Tori spent traveling across Canada, the Stikine, by finding little trapper's cabins and cutting wood and getting warm out of the rain and driving the Telegraph Creek Road and seeing wildlife in northern BC and kind of being on our own, nobody around, compared to jam-packed tourism, Banff, everything so expensive. We spent probably spent more in Banff than anywhere else in the entire trip put together, probably. And going up the gondola, like stressful, all these people packing on and everyone else having a great time. I'm like, man, this ain't for me. You know what I mean? Like, I know the same thing going to like Niagara Falls and peak season.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, thanks. You know what I mean? It's just not that Niagara Falls isn't cool and beautiful, but that's not, you know, some people can do that, but I'm like, man, that's no.
No.
That's kind of what you're talking
about. Yeah, absolutely. Right? Lake Louise was an example. My two daughters went there because they flew out there to meet us this past fall, and they went to Lake Louise. We're like, we're bowing out. We're going on a little hike, and we're going to, like an obscure hike somewhere else.
Yeah.
And we're going to film and photograph little streams coming out of the rocks and stuff. Right. To us, that was just as beautiful and way more fulfilling than going to Lake Louise with literally like 10,000 other people and standing on the shoreline saying, look at this beautiful nature.
Right,
Listen to this beautiful nature. All you hear is voices.
Right, right. And 1,000 tour buses.
Yeah, too, exactly. Yeah. Smelling diesel fuel from the buses. Yeah. Like,
but I get, honestly, for people that's all they can do, maybe they're, you know, they don't have the physical ability.
Yeah, of course.
You know, or they don't have that. That's still beautiful that they have that outlet. I would definitely challenge people to try taking it a little bit of a step further. Okay. Well, Sean, it's been amazing having you here, man. And hopefully we can sit down for another chat again. So thank you. Thanks for coming out.
Well, thanks for having me. It looks like we've got a storm, so a good time to shut it down and head out. And
put a foot of snow on the way today.
So. Yeah. Try to get back to the cabin before we're snowed in.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, pleasure. And we'll do it again soon.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.